You can meet and hear Bill Barr, Albert Moeller, Pavi Rossinen, Chris Roseborough, Brian Wolfmiller, Joel Bierman, and Will Wheaton at the 2022 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, June 24th and Saturday, June 25th in Chicago. For more information, visit IssuesETC.org or call 618-223-8385. The 2022 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 24th and 25th at Concordia University, Chicago.
It is written by Alito, who's a very clear and engaging writer, and it's masterful. I mean, it seems like maybe he's been writing it for years, if not decades.
I think that you would be a complete and total fool for seeing Musk as a champion for any particular set of values that you think is going to restore America to whatever status of ordered liberty and cultural health that you think we should have.
Our justification must come from outside us. It must come from the highest and most definitive authority, Jesus Christ.
What is Lutheranism? Lutheranism is the Church Catholic purged of those medieval errors that did arise in the church in many ways, but did not destroy the church by any means.
Air Force officers on their morning walk enjoy Issues, etc.
Do social conservatives have to sacrifice their goals? Things like ending abortion, opposition to gay marriage, the LGBTQ agenda, the woke agenda, whatever it may be. Do they have to sacrifice those goals politically in order to have economic prosperity? It seems as though many in the conservative American Party, that would be the Republican Party, believe so. Greetings and welcome back to Issues Etc. live on this Tuesday afternoon, May the 10th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to talk social conservatism, economic conservatism, and former Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels. Aaron Wren will join us of the American Reformer. And then we'll talk about the Feast of the Ascension as it was celebrated and observed in the early church. Dr. Joel Olowski of Concordia Seminary will be our guest. Joining us to talk about social conservatism, economic conservatism, and former Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels, Aaron Wren. He's co-founder and senior fellow at American Reformer, writer and consultant in Indianapolis. He's author of a recent column for The Federalist titled "The GOP Pawned Social Conservatism for the Economy and Got Neither." Aaron, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
What is the common myth in Indiana's GOP politics versus the reality?
Well, Republicans have been in charge of the state of Indiana for 16 years, or 17 years if you count the governor's office only, and 11 years if you also include the legislature. So this has been a Republican trifecta state for over a decade. And we've done everything in the conservative playbook. We've cut taxes. We passed constitutional tax caps. We passed right to work. We've passed school choice. You know, we have a AAA credit rating. You name it, we've done it in terms of the conservative playbook. We've cut taxes many times. We just cut taxes again. And originally, I got interested in this space because I saw that the economic results of this were not good. When Mitch Daniels was elected governor in 2004, he said that the central organizing principle of his administration would be to raise Hoosier incomes, the lagging incomes that we had that were below the national average. Well, now, after all this Republican rule, we actually have lower incomes than we did before. We have eroding educational attainment versus the nation. And in fact, our economic and demographic performance had been very poor. So I wrote an article for the conservative policy journal American Affairs that reviewed all of this, that got a ton of discussion, and it subsequently been confirmed by analysis from Ball State University. They've been hitting the same themes. The Brookings Institution has been hitting the same themes, and as well the Indianapolis Star, and even the CEO of the largest corporation in town recently echoed some of the same themes. So originally, my interest came from saying, look, we tried all this conservative orthodoxy, and it just didn't produce prosperity here. And that wasn't necessarily to blame them. What I basically say is, look, the Old North, what I call the Old North, the Midwest, the Northeast, the Great Plains, every one of those states is underperforming. They're all laggards. And what happens and works in a place like Florida or Texas doesn't necessarily work in a cold weather state. And both Indiana and Kansas, with their famous Kansas tax cut experiment, discovered that these sorts of policies didn't really cause economic growth. So that was really my main thing. And then I saw an article in the local city magazine here, Indianapolis Monthly, talking about Trumpist insurgencies in the Indiana Republican Party. And there was sort of this myth, I think, that's been out there and repeated by several people, that the problem in Indiana has been, it's been all these rubes from the country, these rural people who've come in with all their hyper-conservative, social-conservative policies and have made things bad for business. So I just wanted to take a look at the same economic performance and put the lens on it of who's been running the state government and what kinds of social policies have we had. And what I basically showed was Indiana has been predominantly run by what I would call the moderate Republican faction from Indianapolis. There have been very few people from outside the state, very few hardcore conservatives in leadership positions. You know, Governor Mike Pence might be the one exception, but he was governor for less than a quarter of the time that Republicans have held that office on their latest streak. And these Republicans have passed remarkably little social policy legislation, contrary to popular belief. You know, there was one really big incident under the Pence administration where Indiana passed this Religious Freedom Restoration Act, or RFRA, caused a huge firestorm of the corporations. They threatened to leave the state, so the state essentially had to neuter that legislation. But other than that, there's really been remarkably little social conservative legislation. And again, I went back to Daniels. When he ran for president, he proposed, he didn't run for president, but he was talking about running for president in 2012, and he proposed what was known as the truce, which was controversial at the time. And the truce was, we need to call a truce on social issues so we can focus on the budget. And I don't recall him ever using the term truce with reference to Indiana, but that's basically how he governed. His top 100 accomplishments list that he put on the state's website, not one of them is a social conservative policy. And it was all about business, all about government efficiency, all about tax cuts, et cetera. Indiana was actually even one of only three states that never passed a constitutional amendment banning gay marriage. You know, the GOP essentially killed it procedurally in the Senate and never really brought it even to a vote. They said, we're going to kill this off. We're not going to do this. And keep in mind, 29 states passed these constitutional amendments. So Indiana, very conservative state, doesn't do that. There's been a few anti-abortion laws passed. That's the one area where there has been that. But otherwise, there really hasn't been much social conservative legislation. You know, their current governor is one of only two Republican governors to veto the legislation that would have prohibited transgender athletes in girls' sports. You know, it's the first red state that voted down legislation about critical race theory in schools and other things. And if you go through it, Indiana just hasn't enacted much socially conservative legislation. And I think what that shows, again, the other lens I'd put on it is trading away these social issues in favor of the economy doesn't necessarily produce the economic growth. The truth is, Indiana has gotten no credit whatsoever for what it didn't do in social policy legislation.
So why does this myth persist? Why does Indiana have this reputation, at least within Indiana, of being hyper-conservative?
Well, you have to understand that, like most states, there's a big division between the biggest city, which is Indianapolis, and the rest of the state. And Indianapolis is much bluer than the rest of the state of Indiana. You know, the city of Indianapolis had a pretty competitive Republican Party until very recently. In fact, the previous mayor was a Republican, but is definitely more what you would think of as the liberal Republican tradition. And the city of Indianapolis has been, you know, prospering while the rest of the state's not been doing so well. And so, like a lot of bigger cities you see in some of these states, you have this tension between sort of a progressive faction in the city and the more conservative factions in the rest of the state. You see the same thing in, you know, with Tennessee, with Nashville, and Texas, with Austin. Very common pattern. And so the media class resides in Indianapolis. They tend to have much more conservative values, and ergo, they're inclined to blame kind of more conservatives for all the problems. And, you know, they're also very attuned to anything that seems to cross any of the progressive orthodoxies that they like. You know, like a lot of second, third tier type cities, people in Indianapolis who are progressives are very sensitive about status. And so they, it's like everybody who wants to be in the club of cool cities or cool kids. You know, if you're not in the club, you try harder, you follow all the rules harder, you dress even closer to the formula. Whereas the people who are sort of inner party, inner circle, already in, they can be a little more relaxed about it. So, you know, I lived in Manhattan. I lived in one of the most famously progressive neighborhoods in the world, the Upper West Side. And it's pretty relaxed, you know, about a lot of ideologies. You can debate a lot of things because they don't have anything to prove to anybody there in Manhattan. Whereas you come here, you know, the people in these more progressive elements are very sensitive to the fact that everybody out there looks down on Indiana, thinks it's kind of a backward state, which I think is basically going to be the case no matter what we do, to be quite honest. So I think there's a lot of sensitivities on the part of people in cities to anything that smacks at all of conservatism. And of course, most of them in the media class as well are Democrats.
So are there socially conservative factions in Indiana?
Yes, Indiana is not as socially conservative a state as you might think. It's a deep red state. It's definitely conservative in a sense, but its culture is a little more what I call folk libertarian than social conservatives. It's a sort of a get off my lawn conservatism. And it's actually remarkably tolerant in a lot of ways, because as long as you're not causing problems, people pretty much leave you alone. But there are definitely, you know, rural legislators, rural factions, more conservative people in the state who push for various things. I mean, again, they haven't been, call it the ruling class, if you will, or the ruling faction, but they've been present. And the other thing that really causes, I guess, a lot of consternation among these urban classes is a lot of these rural legislators do introduce, you know, very, very conservative pieces of legislation or very anti-urban pieces of legislation. There are a couple of legislators that every year introduce some legislation to try to kill off public transit expansion to Indianapolis, for example. And so there are all these bills that get proposed that people get extremely upset about, sometimes legitimately, because some of them are just plain wacky and dumb. But yet almost none of them actually ever get implemented when you look at it. And so I would just say you really haven't seen, you know, what I would say is a lot of actual social conservative legislation passed. And there's definitely a lot of discontent in the state. How much of it's over social policy is traditionally understood versus what I might call more cultural issues? For example, like guns, I think is more of a cultural issue than a social issue, is to be determined. But I do think there's a lot of discontent among the rank and file Republican voter from around the state. The Libertarian candidate for governor in 2020 set an all-time record high share. It was double-digit percentages, more than doubled the highest amount that had ever been gotten by a Libertarian in the state. And back in 2016, in the Republican primary, exit polling showed that half of Republican voters felt betrayed by their party. So in essence, you know, under Republican rule, the kind of cultural priorities of these rural voters have not been catered to. In fact, in the post-RFRA world, I would just say candidly, it's almost like the central organizing principle of the Republican leadership in the state is the total suppression of the cultural ambitions of the rest of the state. It's like we got to keep a lid on these people because they'll just embarrass us again. And yet, fundamentally, the state's gotten poorer and it's fallen further behind. And, you know, we're in for a rough few years, maybe even a rough decade or two on account of some of the decisions that have been made.
Go into a little more detail, because you say that the truce has worked out fiscally, but not economically. What do you mean?
Well, it is important to keep in mind that I'm putting this truce lens on Mitch Daniels as governor. Well, he never actually used the term truce with regards to state policy. With regards to the national policy, his idea was we really have to focus on the deficit, that the deficit is the problem, the big red menace, as he called it. And he said, we have to put aside social issues to focus on the deficit. As governor, he didn't explicitly call for a truce that I know of, but he certainly essentially ignored every social issue other than abortion. It was basically like if, you know, somebody sends him an abortion bill, he'll sign it, but pretty much otherwise, he's not pushing any of these policies. But I think it's fair to say his focus was more than just fiscal. It was also economic. Now, when he took office, Indiana had a budget deficit of $1 billion and was not really in good shape. We didn't have the huge unfunded pension liabilities or debt levels of other states, in part because there's big constitutional limits on the state of Indiana going into debt as a result of a bankruptcy in the 19th century. We wrote a new constitution that limits state debt, basically prohibits state debt, but you know, we sort of get around that in some cases. But nevertheless, Indiana is not a big debt issuing state. And he cleaned that all up in short order, basically. He completely cleaned up the budget, built a big surplus. And then, you know, the Great Recession hit while he was in office. He was in office, you know, I think from 2005 to 2013. And so that was a time when there was a tremendous fiscal stress. And he really navigated the state well through that. And that probably limited his ability to invest. He couldn't spend a lot of money, even if he wanted to, because, you know, we were just hitting huge budget hits because of the Great Recession. So I would say his fiscal stewardship was actually quite good. But again, the economic results, you can't say it's all on him. In fact, most of the bad economy versus the nation has happened, you know, more or less after he's been out of office. But, you know, essentially, we didn't improve in terms of incomes. We fell further behind. Half of our counties are declining in population. We had our worst decade in history in terms of our comparative educational attainment progress for people with college degrees versus the nation. On down the line, our spending, inflation adjusted, on education declined by 17% during the 2010s. And again, I'm taking some of these from other people's studies. You know, our wage growth from 2000 on was 46th in the country. So we've had a lot of really bad statistics because, in essence, we geared our economy to the very low end of the spectrum. And I don't blame a lack of social policy for that. I don't think that if we'd passed all these social policy bills that Indiana would have necessarily prospered. In fact, I think Indiana is a small, kind of stagnant, weak state that can't go around poking corporate America in the eye in the way that, say, Ron DeSantis can down in Florida. Florida's big, prosperous, can't be ignored. So Indiana probably has to be cautious, quite frankly, in terms of what it does. But even so, it hasn't even done, call them the low risk things that it could have done, like constitutional carry for firearms, which literally just passed this year after, once again, it was killed procedurally last year. I'm like, why not just pass these very popular pieces of legislation that cater to your voters' cultural preferences, where it doesn't conflict with the business agenda? I think the fact that they haven't even been willing to do that has really fueled a tremendous amount of resistance. As I like to say, the natives are starting to get restless.
We're talking about social conservatism, economic conservatism, and former Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels and his truce. Aaron Wren is our guest, co-founder and senior fellow at American Reformer. On the other side, what is the lesson for social conservatives and the GOP and the rest of the country?
You know, the scripture is clear that sometimes we can sin by speaking. Speaking wrongly, speaking untruthfully, speaking in such a way that doesn't reflect Christian love, in a way that isn't accurate.
Dr. Albert Mohler talking about his presentation at this year's Issues Etc. Making the Case conference.
But at the same time, it is also clear that it is unfaithfulness not to speak when we are called to speak. It's actually a sin not to speak when the truth requires that we speak, when courage requires that we speak. And one of the things we know is that the Christian church, as we look through the centuries, sometimes it has erred by speaking wrongly. Sometimes it has erred by speaking boldly or brashly, but it has often erred, especially as we think about our own times, by not speaking clearly, publicly, vocally, and biblically.
You can meet and hear Dr. Albert Mohler at the 2022 Making the Case Conference, June 24th and 25th in Chicago. Learn more at issuesetc.org.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
They've met with the pastor week after week. He's taught them our precepts and Christ Jesus to seek. He shared the law of our God, which we strive to keep, the prayers, the creeds, and the sacraments deep. Now these young saints are right to partake in Christ's body and blood, all for his sake. A gift you are seeking to commemorate this? Ad Crucem has just what you won't want to miss. We've got icons, art, ornaments, jewelry, and more, greeting cards, crucifixes, posters, gifts galore. Your catechized friend will love what you give and treasure the gift all the days that they live.
And when he had said these things, as they were looking on, he was lifted up, and a cloud took him out of their sight. And so Jesus ascended into the heavens and began his session, his sitting at the right hand of God. What does ascension mean for the church? Well, if you've ever wondered that question, you need to pick up your copy of the May issue of the Lutheran Witness, where you'll hear all about how, by his ascension, he brings gifts to men. To order your copy, visit cph.org/witness or visit our website, witness.lcms.org. The Lutheran Witness, helping you interpret the world from a Lutheran perspective.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about social conservatism with Aaron Wren of American Reformer. He's a writer and consultant in Indianapolis and author of a recent column for The Federalist titled "The GOP Pawned Social Conservatism for the Economy and Got Neither." So, Aaron, what is the lesson for social conservatives and the GOP and the rest of the country?
I would just say anybody who tells you that we have to ignore social issues to focus on the economy is telling you to make a bad deal. I think you can assess social issues kind of on their own merits. You know, I always say pass a social policy because you think it's the right thing to do, not because you think it's going to make your economy so much better. You know, I see all these progressives here, you know, in Indianapolis, and they're always saying we have to be very all about diversity and inclusion, because if we don't do diversity and inclusion, you know, it'll be bad for business. People want to locate here. And I say, if you're going to do diversity and inclusion, do it because you think it's the right thing to do. Don't do it because you think it's going to make the market gods love you, because there's no evidence that it does. Texas has been much more socially conservative than Indiana. They passed a constitutional amendment banning gay marriage. They passed a RFRA statute. In fact, it's still on the books in Texas, or at least it was last year. They just passed their very restrictive abortion bill. It has not hurt them in attracting people or jobs. Facebook even announced a big expansion in Austin after they passed the most recent abortion bill. So when you start looking at it, this idea that social policy kind of determines where people and businesses are going to locate, which got very popular as a result of Richard Florida's book, Rise of the Creative Class. You know, it's kind of a long history we don't need to go into there. Yeah, I just think that's really not accurate at the end of the day. Social policy doesn't necessarily determine much about your economy, except on the margins. What matters is if you have what corporations want, which is, at this point, really more than anything, a high-skilled labor force. That's what the businesses of today need. And if you have that, then businesses will do business there.
It sounds a little bit like the GOP leadership in Indiana has been placating social conservatives by basically passing abortion bills. What happens if Roe falls? And that issue is, at least for the time being, more or less taken off the table. It's not as controversial. There'll still be bills, of course. Does that pressure the GOP to pay attention to some of the other social issues?
Well, I think the GOP has done more on social issues this year in the state legislature. They passed constitutional carry. They passed the no transgender athletes in girls' sports bill. And the governor vetoed that, but they've basically said, we're going to override that veto maybe this month when there's a technical corrections day, when the legislature comes back. And they've already said if Roe versus Wade is repealed, they're going to come into special session to pass abortion legislation. And here in Indiana, as with many other states, the governor is actually somewhat constitutionally weak in that it only takes a simple majority to override his veto. So there aren't a lot of vetoes in Indiana because the governor really can't stop legislation from coming into force. Not all states are like the federal government where you need a two-thirds majority in both houses to override a presidential veto. So a lot of states, I think Arkansas is another one, Indiana, they're kind of simple majority or smaller supermajority type vetoes. And so in Indiana, you know, as supermajority Republicans anyway. So, you know, it's very hard for them to, the governor, to stop any bills. And so I think there will be something on abortion. I think it'll be really interesting to see what happens with that, not just in Indiana, but nationally, should Roe versus Wade be overturned.
Are there attempts in the Indiana GOP to double down on the truth?
I definitely think that the Metro Indianapolis faction is completely committed to not engaging on social issues. They're going to continue to essentially do what they've done before. But I think that they are unsatisfied, and certainly the Democrats are, in the amount of money that's been spent on education, you know, where the state's educational levels are so bad. And everybody knows that education is a big problem in the state in terms of our educational attainment levels. So I think they're going to be, you know, they're going to probably say we need to have more diversity and inclusion. We need to have more green energy. We need to do more signaling to the market about our progressive bona fides, and definitely need to stay far, far away from anything socially conservative. Among other things, they're just not social conservatives themselves. They are basically progressives. Even the Republicans, you know, are more socially progressive type people. And so, you know, that's what I think is going to happen. They're not going to support social conservative legislation at all. But we'll see what they end up doing, because, you know, definitely the economy is, you know, we're in such bad shape in a lot of ways that it's going to become increasingly hard to ignore. So they're going to have to do something about that.
Can we take that myth of the truce and write it large on the Republican Party nationally, in particular in Washington, D.C.? Have they also been living with the myth that you have to avoid social issues? Up until Donald Trump, you have to avoid social issues in order to focus on the economy.
You know, look at what they do. Even when Donald Trump was president, what was the major legislative accomplishment? Tax cuts. So essentially, the tax cut, regulatory cut agenda has completely dominated national GOP politics. There's no evidence that anybody in national Republican circles is interested in actually governing. We see this, for example, with the whole Obamacare. We need to repeal and replace Obamacare. Well, they had the opportunity to do that. Did they do that? No, because they actually don't have any ideas about what a healthcare system should look like. They basically like to complain. They like to fundraise off complaints about socialism, and they like to protect pharmaceutical industry profits. They like to protect hedge fund profits. They like to cut taxes. But other than that, they really don't have much of an agenda. And again, to the extent that they have a social or cultural agenda, it's typically opposed to what the rank and file voters want. For example, they want open borders. The rank and file wants a wall with Mexico, wants E-Verify, wants control over our borders and our immigration system. Well, that's anathema to a big chunk of the Republicans in Congress. And if they didn't think that they would lose their jobs over supporting amnesty and all these things, they would do it. And in fact, they've tried to do it many times in the past. So I don't see any evidence that people in Washington even want to pursue any of the social or cultural issues of the, you know, rank and file Republican voter.
Then with just 1 minute here, Aaron, it's highly likely that in November, at least legislatively, the GOP is going to get the car keys back. What do you expect?
I expect them to do nothing, basically. Sorry for the short answer, but that's it.
Aaron Wren is co-founder and senior fellow at the American Reformer, writer and consultant in Indianapolis, and author of a recent column for The Federalist titled The GOP Pawned Social Conservatism for the Economy and Got Neither. You'll find a link to Aaron's website on the Talk on Demand archives page at issuesetc.org. Aaron, thanks.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me.
We will talk the Feast of the Ascension in the Early Church with Dr. Joel Olowski of Concordia Seminary after the break.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start. The foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
Not everyone is comfortable with new technology. Dial A Podcast gives all generations of your congregation an easy way to hear your sermons, or even devotionals and Bible studies. Once you've completed a simple one-time setup, we take care of the rest. All your congregants have to do is dial the number from any phone to listen to your latest podcast, all at no additional cost to them. Dial a Podcast. Extend the reach of your sermons. Get started at dialapodcast.com now.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
When a 2018 fire nearly destroyed Milwaukee's historic Trinity Evangelical Lutheran Church, we got to work, but continued to give the gifts Christ freely gives to his saints here in Milwaukee as we have since 1847. We are nearly two-thirds of the way to completion on this historic restoration, but we need help to finish this work. Will you join us? Please consider joining us. Visit trinitymilwaukee.org for more information. And as pastor, I can't wait to welcome you home to Trinity.
Memoria Press exists to promote and impart the classical heritage of the Christian West through an emphasis on the liberal arts and the great works of the Western tradition. The Memoria Press curriculum encourages the development of wisdom and virtue through the pursuit of truth, goodness, and beauty. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR22. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time. MemoriaPress.com.